Nicholas turned back to his own quarters to get a little more sleep, but as he passed her hut, Roanne popped her head out. "What was all the shouting about? I thought that you and Boris were having another little difference of opinion."
"Tessé has done a bunk.
Boris has guessed that she's gone off with Mech, and he's chasing after them."
"Oh, Nicky, can't we warn them?"
"Oh, no chance of that. But unless Mech has gone soft, he'll be expecting Boris to come after him. In fact, now that I come to think of it, he is probably hoping for just that chance to even the score. No, Mech doesn't need any more help from us. Go back to sleep."
"I can't possibly sleep now, I'm so worked up. I've been looking at the Polaroids that we took last night. Taita has given us an overflowing cup. Come and have a look at this."
"Just 1 hour's sleep more," he made a mock plea.
"Immediately, if not sooner," she laughed at him. In her hut she had the Polaroids and the rubbings spread out on the camp table, and she beckoned him to take the seat beside her. "While you were snoring your head off, I made some progress." She laid 4 Polaroids side by side and placed her large magnifying glass over them. It was a professional land surveyor's model on folding legs, and under it every detail of the photographs was revealed. "Taita has headed each of the sides of the stele with the name of one of the seasons of the year, spring, summer, autumn and winter."
"What do you think he was getting at? Page numbers?"
"Exactly my own thought," she agreed. "The Egyptians considered spring as the beginning of all new life. He is telling us in which order to read the panels. This one is spring." She selected one of the photographs. "It starts with 4 standard quotations from the Book of the Dead." She quoted the first few lines of the opening section. "I am the first breeze blowing softly over the dark ocean of eternity. I am the first sunrise, the first glimmer of light, a white feather blowing in the dawn wind. I am Ra. I am the beginning of all things. I will live forever. I shall never perish." Still holding the glass poised, she looked up at him. "As far as I can see, they do not differ substantially from the original. My instinct is to set these aside for the time being. We can always come back to them later."
"Let's go on with your instinct," he suggested. "Read the next section." She held the glass to the Polaroid. "I'm not going to look at you while I read this. Taita can be as earthy as Rabelais when he's in the mood. Anyway, here goes. The daughter of the goddess pines for her dam. She roars like a lioness as she hurries to meet her. She leaps from the mountain, and her fangs are white. She is the harlot of all the world. Her vagina pisseth out great torrents. Her vagina has swallowed an army of men. Her sex eateth up the masons and the workers of stone. Her vagina is an octopus that has swallowed up a king."
"Oh, whoa there," Nicholas chuckled. "Pretty fruity stuff, don't you think?"
He leaned forward to study her face, for it was still turned away from him.
"Och, lassie, you have roses in your bonny cheeks. Not a blush. Surely not."
"Your Scots accent is not in the least convincing," she told him coldly, still not looking at him. "When you have finished being clever at my expense, what do you think of what I have just read?"
"Apart from the obvious, I haven't any idea."
"I want to show you something."
She stood up and packed the photographs and the rolls of art paper back into the haversack. "You'll need to get your boots on. I'm taking you on a little walk." An hour later they stood in the centre of the suspension bridge, swaying gently high above the swift waters of the Dandera River. "Hapi is the goddess of the Nile. Is this river not then her daughter, pining to meet her, leaping from the mountain top, roaring like a lioness, her fangs white with spume?" she asked him. They stared in silence at the archway of pink stone through which the river poured, and suddenly Nicholas grinned lasciviously. "I think that I know what you are going to say next. That's what I first thought of when I looked at the cleft. You said it was like a gargoyle's mouth, but I had another image." "All I can say is that you must have some extraordinary lady friends," she said, and then covered her mouth. "Oops, I didn't mean to say that. I'm being as disgusting as either you or Taita." "The workmen swallowed up in there." His voice became more excited. "The masons and the workers in stone. Pharaoh Mamoz was a god. The river has swallowed up a god with her stone archway."
She was equally excited. "I must admit that I would not have made the association if you hadn't explored the interior of the cavern and found those niches in the wall." She shook his arm. "Nicky, we have to get in there again. We have to get a clearer look at that bas-relief you found on the cavern wall." "It'll take some preparation," he said dubiously. "I will have to splice the ropes and make some sort of pulley system, and I will have to drill Ali and the other men to avoid a repetition of my last little fiasco. We won't be ready to make the attempt until tomorrow morning at the very earliest." "Well, you get on with it. I'll have plenty to keep me occupied with the translation of the stele." Then she stopped and looked up at the sky. "Listen," she whispered. He cocked his head, and above the sound of the river heard the whining flutter of rotors in the air. "Damn it," he snapped. "I thought we'd lost the Pegasus presence. Come on." He grabbed her arm and hustled her off the bridge. When they reached the land, he jumped down onto the beach, and she followed him. The two of them crept under the hanging eaves of the bridge. They sat quietly on the white sandy beach and listened to the Jet Ranger helicopter approaching swiftly, and then circling back over the hills beyond the pink cliffs. This time the pilot had not spotted them, for he turned away and began to patrol up and down the line of the chasm. Suddenly the engine beat changed dramatically as the pitch altered and the pilot pulled up the collective. "Sounds as if he's going in for a landing up there in the hills," Nicholas said, as he crawled out from under the bridge. "I'd feel a lot easier without them snooping around." "I don't think we have too much to worry about," Royan disagreed. "Even if they are connected with Duryad's killers, we are still way ahead of them. Obviously they have not tumbled to the importance of the monastery and the stele." "Well, I hope you're right. Let's get back to camp. We must not let them see us in the vicinity of the chasm again. It will be too much of a coincidence for them to find us hanging around here every time they come this way." While Royan went to her hut and pored over her photographs and etchings, Nicholas worked with the trackers and skinners. He spliced the unravelled end of the nylon rope to the second hank to make a single length 500 feet long. Then he cannibalized the canvas fly of the cooking hut, cutting it up and whipping the raw edges to make a sling seat. He fashioned the ends of the rope into a harness, which he spliced into the four corners of the canvas seat. He had no block and tackle, so he put together a crude gantry of poles, which could be extended out over the cliff edge to keep the rope clear of the rock. The rope would run through the groove that he drilled in the end of the central beam with a red-hot iron. He lubricated it with cooking lard. It was the middle of the afternoon by the time he had completed his preparations. Then, leaving Royan in camp, he led his men, burdened with the coils of rope and the pole sections of the gantry, back up the pathway to the spot where he had abseiled down into the ravine to retrieve the carcass of the Dictic. From there they worked their way downstream, following the rim of the cliff. It was heavy going, for thorn scrub grew right up to the edge, and in many places they were forced to use their machetes to hack their way through. The sound of the waterfall guided him. As they moved downriver, it grew louder, until the rock seemed to quiver under his feet with the roar of falling waters. Finally, by leaning over the edge and peering downwards, Nicholas could make out the flash of spray in the depths below. "This is the spot," he grunted with satisfaction, and explained to Ali in Arabic what he wanted done. In order to determine the exact position in which to set up the gantry, Nicholas climbed into the canvas sling seat and had them lower him 20 feet down the cliff face, just as far as the beginning of the overhang. Up to that point, he was able to keep the nylon rope from abrading on the rock, but he was also able to see around the bulge of the face. Hanging backwards over the falls and the rocky bowl of the river, 150 feet below him, he was able, at last, to see the double row of niches in the rock face. However, the bas-relief engraving was still hidden from view by the tumble home of the cliff. He gave Ali the signal, and they hauled him up. "We must set up the gantry a little further down," he told him, and directed them as they hacked away the dense shrubbery that choked the rim. Then suddenly he exclaimed, "I'll be damned!" He went down on one knee to examine the rim rock that the thorns had concealed. "There are more excavations here." Exposed to the elements, unlike those works further down that had been protected by the overhang, these were badly eroded. There were just vague traces remaining in the rim rock, but he was certain that these indentations were the upper anchor points for the ancient scaffolding. They set up their own gantry on the same levelled area, and extended the long pole out over the drop. Then they rigged and secured it with a crude cantilever system of ropes and lighter poles. When they were finished, Nicholas crawled out to the end to test the structure and to run to the end of the rope through the slot he had prepared for it. The whole structure seemed solid and firm. Nevertheless, it was with relief that he crawled back to solid ground. He stood up and looked over the tops of the thorn scrub to where the lowering sun was fuming red and angry on the horizon. Enough for one day, he decided. The rest can wait for tomorrow. The next morning, Nicholas and Royan were both up and drinking coffee at the campfire while it was still dark. Arlie and his men were squatting at their own fire nearby, talking quietly and coughing over the first cigarettes of the day. The project seemed to have caught their imagination. They had no inkling of the reason for this second descent into the chasm, but the enthusiasm of the two Ferengi was infectious. As soon as it was light enough to see the path, Nicholas led them back up into the hills. The men chatted cheerfully amongst themselves in Amharic as they hurried through the thorn scrub, and they came out on the rim rock just as the sun broke over the eastern escarpment of the valley. Nicholas had drilled the men the previous day, and he and Royan had sat half the night going over the plans, so each of them knew their part, and they lost little time in setting themselves up for the descent. Nicholas had stripped to shorts and tennis shoes, but this time he had brought along an old barbarian's rugby jersey for warmth. While he pulled this over his head, he pointed out to Royan the platform that had been dug out from the solid rock. She examined it carefully. "It's very hard to be sure, but I think you're right. This probably is man-made. When you get further down, you will have no doubts. There's very little weathering of the face under the overhang, and the niches are almost perfectly preserved, until they reach the high water mark, that is," he told her, as he took his seat in the sling and swung out over the cliff. Dangling from the end of the gantry, he gave Ali the sign, and the men lowered him down into the gorge. The rope ran smoothly through the lubricated slot. He saw at once that he had judged it correctly, and that he was descending in line with the double row of niches. He came level with the enigmatic circle on the cliff face, but it was 50 feet from him, and a growth of gaudy coloured lichens had streaked and discoloured the rock, partially obscuring the details, so that he still could not be certain that it was not a natural floor. He passed it and went on down, as Ali and his team paid out the rope from above. When he reached the surface of the water, he slipped out of the sling and dropped in. The water was very cold. He trod water, gasping, until his body became acclimatized. Then he gave Ali 3 tugs on the signal rope. While the canvas seat was hauled up, he swam to the side of the pool and held on to one of the carved stone niches for support. He had forgotten how gloomy and cold and lonely it was here in the bottom of the chasm.